That's okay. So, yeah, my name is Dave Snoke, and I want to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me and for this interesting session, and also for all of you for sticking around this late. I know it's getting toward the... You can't hear me? Is this not on?
Hello?
No?
Hello? Hello?
Okay. Okay, that's much better. So, again, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. Yes? So now is an AV issue? So this is the recording one, but it's not giving any sound. Oh, okay. All right. All right. Now we're all set. Okay, so the title of my talk is It Wrong to Quantify Wonder? And I chose this title because I think that that's actually part of the debate between the ID-friendly people and the ID-unsympathetic people, is that we all sort of, again, I think the theme of this conference has been that we agree that there is something to be wondered at, that there is something wondrous about God's creation. And so then what are we disagreeing about, in a sense, is the question. And a lot of it, I think, is people being uncomfortable with people in the ID community putting numbers on things and saying, not just when I look at this, I feel good, but in fact saying that this actually proves or quantifies in some way that God really did it. And that's what bothers people more. Well, before I get into my argument, I want to start with actually just thinking about what is it that we're wondering at. Let's think about really what we're dealing with. You know, we're familiar with outer wonders. These are, you know, the starry sky. I showed some trees and waterfalls in the previous slide. This is something that's a little bit hard to pick up there. This is the large-scale structure of the universe, something that just in the past couple decades has come out, that even beyond the stars that you see there, there's larger-scale structure. And that top one there is a famous picture called the Stick Man, where when they first looked at the large-scale structure of the universe, that was the first picture that came out, and it looks like a stick man. And that actually turns out to be part of a much larger structure, which you can see there. And so, on the other hand, as we look inside the cell, we see things that are also fascinating. And so looking inside, I have some music because I think part of the wonder, you have to see this with music. So bear with me. Well, and hopefully this sound will pick up here. But I think these are really worth watching. And all of this, by the way, is stuff from not ID hacks making these things, but this is just general people doing this. Can you hear the music? So I'm not going to even bother to try to commentate all these things. These are cellular processes going on inside the cell, constantly inside every one of them. There's so many flying paths, I can't even do them justice. But you see, there's just a beauty to it, the weaving of these things in them. We heard some talks this morning about how genes are spliced together. These are the microtubule structures here. I think it shows pictures of them being built here. So even these microtubules themselves are constantly being shortened and lengthened. And this is a great thing. This is the kinesin molecule of waffling the microtubule. This is not some kind of artificial thing. That's the atomically correct picture of it. And when I showed this to a teenager, that's messenger RNA there, and that's going to be read out and used to produce proteins in a little factory. Again, that's the readout mouse. The protein comes out at the bottom. someone mentioned earlier. Okay, I'm going to show just one more movie because I think we really need to have that sense of wonder. Okay, yeah, before I do that, here's a little, Here's a picture of the kinesin molecule. And again, these things are worked out. These are several people's theses over decades to establish even the working of one of these. But all of that, the pictures that you saw in the previous movie were not just artists, broad artist conceptions, but were really carefully worked out in terms of how these things actually work with the molecules. That's the kinesin walking molecule that pulls along the cargo along the microtubules to take things from one place to the other inside the cell. This is another one. This is the famous flagellum. I'll start this guy as well here. And this is dealing with the fabrication process of the flagellum. And I think I had to put some music in for this one too, so I stole it from the previous, the Harvard one. Maybe. It's a those are protons flying in, so it's a proton pump. And this thing is actually going to weave this. That's a universal joint. A universal joint is a joint that keeps an angle even as it turns. And now it's going to stop the universal joint, and it's going to make the tail as a separate function now. And this little thing on the top is going to weave it as it goes. So the tail, these flagella, are not just like pieces of hair that are hanging there. I'm going to speed up the process in a minute real quick here. So that's all going on inside. You have multiple ones which are all turning simultaneously, but they don't tangle because they don't have universal joints. Okay, so this is just another one. I think this is much quicker. This is the replosome for DNA. This is amazing to me. Dave Keller gave me this movie. This is one where you have two strands of DNA being pulled out, and the thing that duplicates it works one way along the DNA, but of course you've got opposite helicity, and so one of them is working one way, the other one's working inward, and the only way to do that is to keep pulling out more DNA so that it can keep working inward, and so you have a little mechanism to pull strands out so it can keep working in, and then pulling out more again. Okay, so you see how that's going to happen. Once it gets back, it releases a section, pulls that off, and then pulls out another loop. Keep doing it. So, and your DNA would not copy if this wasn't working. This is the way all of your DNA is replicated. Okay, and this is just one last one. This is, again, this is not just an artist's conception. This is from Dave Keller's work at the University of New Mexico, where it actually identified the right location for all these atoms and exactly how this thing works. So hopefully I can get this thing to start. Sometimes it's a little touchy. There it goes. Okay. So that's the polymerase. It's copying. It's taking a single strand of the DNA and then bringing in material from the outside and copying it in. So that's just repeating now. So it's making it into a double strand after taking a single strand and bringing in stuff from the environment. And so it looks like it's weaving, right? It's a beautiful, beautiful little thing. Okay. Well, so what Dave Keller has done is gone a little further and say, well, can we put some numbers on this to say what could we say about probabilities here? So one thing that he's done is to parameterize this into a bunch of machine parameters that have to line up. And so you have, for example, here are two things that are going to get matched in here that have to match with two things on the other side in order to put them together. And if they don't line up, it's sort of like walking along railroad tracks. If you don't match your pace to the distance between the ties, you start to get off and you fall off. And so this little replicase has to have a spacing equal to the spacing of the rungs of the DNA ladder, otherwise it gets off. And so you could then start to ask questions about, well, how finely tuned is this? What's the odds of this thing doing this on its own with just random parameter generation? And that's where people start to get uncomfortable. Why is it that many people are uncomfortable with quantitative arguments for design? One thing that sometimes I hear people say is simply, it makes it seem not very wondrous anymore if you start putting numbers on it. Some people will say that about all science. I used to really enjoy nature until I took a biology class, and then I had to memorize all this stuff, and it wasn't fun anymore. And sometimes people talk about that that way as Christians, that, well, I just know that God created nature, and I see that. And once you start talking about arguments for probabilities and so on, it just seems to me you're taking away the wonder and you're obfuscating things. Well, the fact is that this comes out of the fact that we do have a lot of built-in human functions. And there's a lot of things that we sort of know when we see them and when we feel them. And for a long time, we didn't have any kind of quantifiable discussion. So, for instance, temperature. We all have temperature sensors. And you could have a debate with somebody about whether the room is too hot or too cold, and somebody else would say, well, I think it's hot, somebody else thinks it's cold. You're using vaguely defined senses. And yet, of course, we know now we have a thermometer. We don't have to debate. We can say it doesn't feel good, but we can agree on, here's a number that goes with that temperature. In the same way, we can talk about pressure. We sense pressure through our skin. And more higher level are voice recognition and face recognition. These are things that, again, we associate with very personal feelings. I recognize my wife's voice. I recognize my kid's voice. Does that mean it's somehow demeaning to come up with a computer program that recognizes voices? Does it mean it's impossible? In the same way, there are face recognition computer programs. And many people would say, well, I love my wife's face. I know her face. And so in a similar way, you might say, well, then if I quantify that and I come up with a computer program to recognize faces, then that would somehow be lowering my sense of love for my wife. But that doesn't necessarily follow for me. To me, you can say simultaneously, I could make an algorithm to identify this, to identify what we're talking about, without saying that, I only turn it over to the computers and the mathematicians. The two can run parallel. Now, one of the things that often goes into this is the fact that because we have these built-in senses, we sometimes have vague cutoffs and places where it falls apart. So it's pretty well known that small children, babies, have built-in face recognition function that we have from birth, the ability to see faces. And so it's very important for a baby to recognize its mother's face. And so one of the things that we see is that we get a lot of false positives. A lot of times, see faces. You've probably seen in weird patterns of wallpaper, you see a face. And, of course, then there are the famous toasts that get sold on eBay. If you look at that carefully, some people will say that you can see Mary in there. If you see a woman's face there, if you look long enough, see, it's vague. It's not clear, right? This one, maybe you'll have an easier time with this one. Some people, that one was sold on eBay for some thousands of dollars, I believe. That's a very famous piece of toast. And what's going on there? Well, a lot of people will mock that, but what's going on is the fact that we have this built-in face recognition function, and there's the clear-cut cases where we say, that's obviously my wife's face. There's clear-cut non-face cases, and then there's some vague boundary in between. We can have false positives. That doesn't mean one of two things. It doesn't mean that our face recognition function is totally bogus and we should not trust it. Because, in fact, we all do know that we recognize faces. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that it's not something that we could turn over to a computer either. It's possible, and what we would like to say is we've got some kind of numerical scale to say, well, if I have a clear Kodak picture of my wife's face, I would give that a 10, and I call this maybe like a 3 on the face scale. where it's not a zero, but it's not exactly a 10 either. And so I think that I think the analogy is very good with face and voice recognition, that we don't have to throw out quantitative discussions when we think about talking about design. We can say some things look really, really designed and other things don't. So, for example, here's something that you don't know what it is, right? Does anybody recognize the function of this thing? Probably not. But you see it and you say, that looks designed. And you don't have a problem saying that is designed by some person. For all you know, it could have been designed by an alien race. There's no English letters on it. So that one's a pretty easy call. Now, this one's a little bit less designed, but you still would look at that and say, well, I still would identify that as design. I'm not entirely clear about it. But on the other hand, if you look at something like this, how many people would be willing to bet their house that this is definitely designed and not just some chip that fell off of a cliff somewhere? Would you be willing to bet your life on that? And so you could say, well, it looks sort of designed, but it looked like it had some things in common with that one, so maybe this is a knife. But it's a little bit more vague, and it becomes more of a debatable topic. So I think it's reasonable to talk about degrees of design in some kind of quantitative number to say that we have some sense of certain things are just obvious when we look at them, and other things are much less obvious. So what kind of proposals would we have for identifying design things? There's been a lot of them that have been floated over the years, not all just in the recent years, but some going way back. Let me just give you sort of the general idea of what we're working toward and what I think is sort of the standard argument of intelligent design. It's essentially an inductive argument. It says, if I have a set of all the known, all the design things that I know are designed because I saw the process or I know some person who told me the story of it, and I identify some property A that they all have in common. And then I say, well, I also have another set of things that are all known not to be designed, and I know that none of them have property A. Now I come across some third category of things which I don't know whether they're designed or undesigned, and one of them has property A. The inductive argument would be, well, then I say it's probably designed because all my previous experience says things that are designed have property A. So there's two questions. One is, what could constitute property A? And I want to go in to talk about that. But there's another question actually that comes up before that that bothers a lot of people. And I wrote an essay on this in the ASA Journal a couple of years ago. The premise of that inductive argument is to say I've got one set which is designed and another set which is undesigned. But many Christians would get off the boat right there and say, wait a minute, everything in the universe is designed by God. So how can you talk about some set of things which are undesigned? It sounds like you're impugning God and saying parts of the universe are not well made. We would say that everything is designed. Well, I would agree with that, but I would say that we still do, in practice, make distinctions between things that are designed and undesigned. And again, I wrote a fairly lengthy essay on this, which I'm just going to summarize here, which is to say, if you think about different levels of our experience, in our own domain of control, there are certainly things which we can say, I know the history of, and some of these things are designed and some are undesigned. So, for example, I can be in a wood shop, and I can make a bunch of birdhouses. And I have, these birdhouses did not exist before, and now they exist. So I can rightly say that I made the birdhouses. I can also say, of course, in the providence of God, before all time, he ordained that these birdhouses should exist. But what's relevant right now is that I made the birdhouses, and it would not be appropriate to say they just popped into being or God made them, but rather to say I made the birdhouses. But I also made something else. I also made this disorderly pile of sawdust. And I can say at my level of experience, here are two things that I originated, I was a creator of. Again, not going back many steps to talk about God's providence, but just talking about in the here and now, I created two things. One of them was very designed, and the other one was not designed. And so I know the history of these things, and they're in my domain of control. I can talk about whether they were designed or not. And I see that the things at my level that are designed or undesigned have very different properties. In my paper, I talk about it's very analogous to the problem of free will and evil, that we can talk about God's providence at one grand level, but at another level, it's still very appropriate to say, you did it, and don't say God did it. You did it, and you're responsible. In the same way, we can talk about God making all the atoms, and there's a beautiful design in all the atoms and laws of physics and so on. But at another level, we certainly do see randomness, and it's just silly to say there's no such thing as randomness. The example that I have, another example I have, is a teenager's bedroom, where you would say the relevant domain of control here is the teenager. Okay, not talking about atoms and molecules here, but the relevant domain of control is what was the teenager's intent. And what we see here is that there are certain things that are very disorderly, but on the other hand, you can see the books on the shelves are all stacked neatly, and we would say those have a different property than the things that are sort of randomly strewn on the floor. So can we identify what that property is? By the way, I'm assuming that I have 45 minutes. Is that correct? It wasn't clear in the... What's that? Okay, well, it wasn't... But the session goes. Anyway, if you want to knock me off, I'll actually probably go like 35 minutes or so. I'm not going to try to use all the time. Okay, so here are some possible proposals that people have floated. One of them is the idea of order. Well, that's actually a problematic definition because, in fact, just cooling down atoms and molecules if they have strong bonds leads to order. And we would say, well, that's not a design thing. That's actually the most random configuration that those atoms can be in. The reason why we tend to associate that with design is because if we see at our scale order, we don't have strong bonds between things at our level that make them magnetically attract each other typically. And so the order at the level of something like these rocks would have to be imposed. Improbability, I'm going to run through these fairly quickly here. Improbability is one that's been floated again. The problem is that any dice throw is equally improbable. We want something more than just improbability. Some people floated the idea of few equivalent states, just taking the opposite, the negative sign times the entropy and saying, well, the lower the entropy, the more design. But of course, then that just means that cooling makes something more design, which doesn't seem right. Complexity, total information content is sometimes floated as how many bits do you need to describe it? The problem with that, of course, is that any random pattern takes a lot of bits to describe, and it's very complex. And so we're getting at something here, but we're not quite getting it. Now, a couple that have been floated very well known in ID circles, one is Behe's idea of irreducible complexity, which is to say to add an extra thing, not just complexity, but also some function which depends on that complexity. And a problem with that is it's sort of a binary test. Yes, no, is it designed or not? And Bill Dembski has floated a very similar one, which you could call specified complexity. And again, it's a binary test saying yes, no, it's designed or not. And also there's a problem of, well, can we really identify these intrinsic or a priori specifications? Well, what I'm going to float is the idea of sensitivity or what sometimes is called fine-tuning as a design criterion. And the logic is the following. If we say in a well-designed system, every little thing matters. That's what we think of as intrinsically something that goes with good design is that the person put everything there for a purpose. And so it follows from that then that changing one little thing would mess up the design because the person, the designer, has not put in all this extraneous stuff. And so if I change one little thing, it would have a big effect on the whole. And so we would expect sensitivity. In other words, we'd expect in some generalized terms a large change of function for a small change of internal parameters. And so that argument, for instance, is made with the fine-tuning of the cosmos. People would say if you change the constants of nature, the value of E, the charge of the electron, by a tiny amount, huge changes happen in the universe. And so that tends to be something that we associate with something funny going on, which we would associate with design. Now, you might say, is there a counterexample? What about modern art? Okay, that's designed, but is it something that you would say it depends on every little bit, or is it random? Well, I would propose this. If you think that every little piece doesn't matter, then go into the museum, take a magic marker, and change a little bit and see whether anybody cares. In fact, I think they do care, and the artist would say, even though you can't see it, I put everything there for a reason, and you can't change any of it. And so it's really there. It actually all does matter, even if you can't see it. Now, the reverse, you could ask, is what about an avalanche? Okay, an avalanche is something where a tiny little perturbation causes a huge change. You'd say, well, is that a design system? But that actually leads to another consideration. We generally have an idea of inside and outside of systems. Think about a car motor. If you have a motor and you look under the hood and you remove a small part, you're going to make a huge change in the function. Okay, so that would be an indication of design. On the other hand, if you're driving down the road under normal driving circumstances and the car falls apart with some tiny perturbation, you'd say that's a badly designed car. So a typical system has internal and external parameters, and you're saying it should be robust against external changes, but you expect it to be finely sensitive to internal changes because the internal system is not supposed to be tinkered with. It's supposed to stay the same. And so actually, I would say a good design is both robust against external change and highly sensitive to internal change. And so the nice thing about this definition is it's physically measurable. We can simply say its sensitivity factor is such and such, regardless of whether we're saying that that is leading to a creator or whatever. Now, I just want to throw this out as a debating point. I find it odd that in the ASA and in a lot of circles, there's a general acceptance of fine-tuning arguments in cosmology and not in biology. And I simply don't understand that. To me, I'm seeing the same type of things. I'm seeing things that are highly, highly sensitive to tiny little changes. And that, to me, is indicative that every little part matters and every little part is there for a reason. And so, for some reason, it's become generally accepted to have cosmological fine-tuning arguments, but to reject fine-tuning arguments in biology. And I tend to see them as the exact same argument, just at different levels. Sometimes people will say, well, how do you know in biology that you won't come up with some other explanation for this fine-tuning that we see in biology? But of course, the same is true in cosmology. How do you know that we won't come up with a proper parallel universes or some other explanation for that as well? And so if you're worried about people coming up with other explanations, you've got to make the same argument both in cosmology and in biology. Okay, well, for my last 5 minutes, I want to spend a little time on just a little quantified work that I've done. And this is really just taking a stab, and I'm going to just do this in a really broad brush. We've been having various meetings over the past few years of ID sympathizers and less sympathetic people getting together and sort of challenging each other. And one of the things that we, actually Lauren Harzma, who's sitting back there, encouraged me, was to say, well, one of the problems with an ID, a lot of ID research is it says, well, evolution doesn't work. If we do this, nothing happens. There's no, you know, there is no evolution. And the problem with that is it's boring, right? You say, well, okay, I did this experiment and I got nothing. And it's always hard to have a null result like that. So his challenge was, well, let's see if we can make something evolve and then see what was required in it and to see whether we could actually, you know, now that we've made it, what would happen in that case. So this actually was inspired by a paper in PhysRev Letters, which is a very prestigious journal in physics, last year by a former professor of mine, Nigel Goldenfeld. And he came up with a model for scalable model of evolution. And one of the things, I'm giving this a real broad brush, but one of the things that he was arguing, which I thought was very persuasive, is that we should abandon the idea of fitness landscapes. Because a fitness landscape is static. You reach the top of it and you're done. Whereas if you want to have ongoing evolution, you have to have some kind of continuous, ever upward kind of process. Well, he made one model. I made a different model. And let me just tell you a few elements of it. We're going to visualize if each organism is making a bunch of chains in some generalized parameter space. And we're saying that there are basically functional targets somewhere out there in space, which are the blue dots there. And the sort of quasi-genome corresponds to making little random motions in this parameter space, which might correspond to different properties of molecules and so on. And the thing that we're going to do, though, is we're going to say there has to be an energy cost for carrying each of these things. So every time I add a link to this chain, which is the black line here, every time I add a link to that chain, I pay a fitness cost. So I have an energy cost to that link. Now, on the other hand, we would say there's some huge benefit for fitness if you actually hit, through a random walk of this chain, hitting one of these function targets. And so we actually could run this model. I did this over the past summer, making this this little model. And so each organism generates a bunch of chains, and its fitness is then measured relative to other organisms around it, not relative to some absolute fitness landscape, but just relative to the other organisms. And its fitness is the total number of function targets it's hit times that reward minus the length of the chains. And the question then is, well, will this thing grow? Will eventually the organisms hit a lot of targets? And can we get those targets to be hit on a continuous basis so the thing keeps getting more and more complex? So let me stop and just ask for your intuition. Okay, so everyone form an opinion. We won't raise hands, okay, but form an opinion of what you think will happen in a model like this. And I'll help you out. Let's take two extremes. Okay, suppose there was no value, there was no reward at all for hitting those targets. Okay, well, what's going to happen then? Well, the chains will just diffuse out, and at some point they'll hit some maximum average length where the weight of the chains is so great that they have too much of a negative fitness impact, and they won't grow anymore. Right? So if you don't have any reward, then the chains grow to some maximum length and stop. And so they don't keep hitting more function targets. They hit the nearest few, and then they stop. Okay? Now let's take the opposite limit. What if we have a huge, huge reward for the targets so that the cost of the chains is negligible? Okay, what would happen in that case? Well, in that case, there's no penalty for having a million chains, vestigial chains. Right? So you would hit lots of function targets, but you also have lots of chains hitting no targets because there's no cost for them, because their cost is negligible compared to the reward that you're getting from hitting targets. So your strategy in that case is it's just going to fill space with random chains and hit every target. Okay, so the question is, can we tune the parameters in between those two limits somehow? And the short answer is no. The short answer is that if you actually run the model, you see two things. One is you can get a constant increase of the number of rewards hit. So that's these jagged lines here. And you can get that to continue indefinitely, that it will constantly work its way through space, grabbing more and more targets. But the fitness actually rises at first because of hitting all those targets, but ultimately collapses. And in every case, there's a fitness collapse of the population. And the reason is because eventually the burden of all these extra chains weighs it down, all that extra energy. Now, you could say, well, isn't there an optimization process by which it's going to get rid of those non-functional chains? But the problem is that in order to do this diffusion in the first place, you had to not have that cost be too large, or else it would just have killed everything. They wouldn't have gone very far. But if you make it fairly low, then what happens is there's not much penalty for carrying them at first, and so it spreads throughout the population. Everybody's carrying these chains, and so now you can't measure yourself relative to somebody else. So you keep accumulating more chains, and eventually the whole population keeps increasing these number of chains. And so they're all carrying this vestigial stuff. And so this is another way of looking at it. This is the vestigial fraction. I'm calling vestigial meaning non-functioning things that are being built. And so what you see is there's initially a drop, a very quick drop, where the gain functions, it goes down to only 20% of the chains are not hitting targets on average, which is pretty good. But then you keep letting it go, keep letting it evolve, and eventually the non-functioning fraction approaches unity. Because the more reward targets they pick up, the less penalty there is for carrying chains. And so the chains start to multiply. So I'm not going to go into any more detail on that model other than to say that this issue of non-functional or vestigial things is, to me, one that's greatly overlooked in the literature, that in general, you can do blind search by building a lot of stuff and making stabs in the dark, but then you're going to have a lot of things that didn't hit anything that you just built. So like, you know, in Dawkins' view of creating the eye, you say, well, you could have created the eye by a process of first making an indentation and then making a light spot and so on. But you would expect, actually, organisms to have lots of things like that were sort of half eyes or half legs, And then the argument is, well, but you get rid of them because once you've got a real working one, then the other ones, you know, are just extra energy costs that you don't want to carry. But the problem is that it's hard to get rid of them because you've got such a benefit for having an eye. The penalty of having a bunch of half-eyes is very little compared to the benefit of having an eye. So it's much more likely to have one working eye and 20 non-working eyes than it is to have, you know, a single working eye or no eyes at all. So this is just a flavor for the kind of thing that some of us have been working on in trying to say, well, what can we say quantitatively about design systems? And this is where we're working from the reverse side, saying, well, if we have an undesigned system, what would you expect? Notice what happens here. If I look at this system now, it's got 95% vestigial stuff. So that means I could go in, if I change something, 95% chance that I'm not going to change the function of the system because most of the stuff is not working. It's exactly what you would expect for an undesigned system. It does acquire function, but it's not very sensitive to small changes if I change something in the system because most of the stuff is vestigial. Whereas a well-designed system, you expect every little thing matters. So let me finish up with this then. Overall, models of increasing biocomplexity need to be concerned about this problem of suboptimality, of having a bunch of extra stuff that isn't doing anything. This is in contrast to a statement of, it's really going around. I encourage you all to pay attention to what's called systems biology. This is huge in the biophysics field right now, which is actually, there are whole fields. There was 8 parallel sessions at the last March meeting in physics of people saying this is the first time we've had quantitative physics where we can really make predictions. And the way we do it is by assuming optimality. We assume that living systems are working as best as they possibly can. And from that, we then make predictions and we see them being fulfilled. Now, I call that intelligent design science, but of course they're not going to give credit that way. But they don't justify this assumption of optimality other than that it works, other than saying that, in fact, if you assume that living systems are nearly optimal. I put this bat up there because Bill Bielek was up at Pitt a few months ago, and he used the example of the bat, which has time resolution in its 20 nanoseconds. And they determined that it can't be better than 20 nanoseconds because of the motion of the air would spoil. In other words, it's optimal hearing. It can't be any better for the parameter space that it's exploring. So I'll just leave up these general conclusions. A computer algorithm to identify a face does not remove the love I may have for that face. Attempts at quantitative definitions of design do not need to change our love for God. And in fact, we do see these fine tuning at all levels of nature. Thanks.